Well, brethren, the topic of this panel really got changed when October 7th of this year took place. At that time, there was a complete violation of norms of international law, a brutal, brutal attack. And the world's response is, gee, that's too bad. We're saturated with the news of what's been taking place. This panel's going to be different in that it's going to look at five separate issues. And let's see, let me get the next slide forward. We're going to be looking at what the posture and actually the division within Israel was up to the time of the October 7th attack. That's Brother John Bevall and Joe Migas. We're going to be looking at the emergence of anti-Semitism, not only here in the U.S., but throughout the world. That'll be the task of Brother Chris Nabchinsky and Brother Darek Shivak. Strategic alliances. We recognize prophetically that we're transitioning from one set of enemies against Israel to the set of enemies that are prophesied in Ezekiel, and we want to focus on that. We've asked Brother Brent and Brother Jack to help us through that. The continuing polarization that characterizes this time, there's no middle ground. Everybody's an extremist. That's going to be the assignment of Brother Aaron Keymichael and Brother Joe Migas. And last, what we can be doing to comfort Israel. And we've asked Brother Brett and Brother Chris to pick up on that along with participation from us. If we have time, we'd like to be able to get some comments from the brethren in addition, but our time is going to be constrained. So having said that, I'm going to just turn it over now to Brother John and Brother Joe Migas. Would you please tell us about Israel today and what took us up to the attack?
Thank you, Brother Richard. Each panel member has a total of about 9 or 10 minutes to divide as he chooses among the topics that we will discuss today. And I'm going to use my entire time to give a history of Israel and the Palestinian people, which will necessarily be fast-paced and very cursory, focusing on those living in the Gaza Strip today. In 1948, an estimated hundreds of thousands of Palestinian men, women, and children gathered up whatever belongings they could carry in their hands and left behind forever the homes, farms, and villages that their families had lived in for generations. They walked for miles to the Gaza Strip and to the west bank of the Jordan River. Why? Who were these people? And how do they relate to the Gaza war today? To answer that question, we go all the way back to 2045 BC, when the land of Canaan, already occupied by tribes of Canaanites, was given by God to Abraham and his generations. The three main Old Testament descriptions of the boundaries of that promised land are variously interpreted and drawn on maps, but all of them include what today is called the Gaza Strip and the west bank of the Jordan River. In Joshua 15, Gaza is specifically named as part of the inheritance of the tribe of Judah. Fast forward in time to the period of the kings of Israel, and we find Israel's enemy, the Philistines, living in modern-day Gaza. Forward again to the time of the Roman Empire, and after the last of Israel's rebellions against the empire was quashed, the name Syria Palestina was given to the Roman province around the year 200 AD. The name Palestina is thought to have derived from Philistia, the land of the Philistines. Fast forward to 1914, and just before World War I, Palestine, as it was now called, was part of the Ottoman Empire. When the war ended, the Ottoman Empire, having been on the losing side, was required to give up the land of Palestine. But what country should now govern the people living there? Following the Balfour Declaration in 1917, the League of Nations in 1920 issued the British Mandate, giving Great Britain the burden of temporarily administering the government of Palestine. And it proved to be nothing but trouble for Great Britain for 25 years, with all the conflicts between longtime Palestinian Arab residents on one side and the increasing influx of Jewish refugees fleeing the persecution of the Nazi Holocaust on the other. Between just the 3 years of 1936 and 1939, some 5,000 Arabs and 500 Jews were killed in armed skirmishes. A more permanent solution had to be found. In 1947, the newly formed United Nations developed a two-state solution to partition the land of Palestine into two states, one Jewish, the other Arab. Neither the Jews nor the Arabs liked the proposed map at all, which showed the borders of the two new countries. But the proposal was voted on and passed as United Nations Resolution number 181 on November 29, 1947, and it would take effect on the day Britain would choose to declare their mandate ended. The next day, November 30, 1947, a civil war broke out between the Arabs and Jews in Palestine. Over the next 5 months, roads were barricaded, buses and railways were bombed, houses were destroyed, and innocent families on both sides were murdered. The Palestinian refugees I mentioned at the beginning of this history fled from the violence. Palestinians call this forced migration Nakba, which means the catastrophe. And it should also be acknowledged, a large number of Jews, having more recently settled in what was now the future state of Palestine, left their homes and resettled within the Jewish partition. Meanwhile, the United Kingdom, eager to get out of the intractable violence, declared the British mandate would end on May 14, 1948. And when that day came, the British flag over Palestine was lowered, and David Ben-Gurion announced the rebirth of the State of Israel. The very next day, the first Arab-Israeli war began. The intent of the Arab nations was to destroy the one-day-old nation of Israel and, if need be, kill all the Jews. Israel won that war, and also a second war in 1967, after which Israel gained control over the Gaza Strip, the West Bank, the Golan Heights, as well as much of the Sinai Peninsula, which was soon after returned to Egypt after a peace treaty between Israel and Egypt was signed in 1979. Since 1947, the tens of thousands of Palestinian refugees who fled to Gaza lived in refugee camps, without homes or jobs, entirely dependent on others in Gaza and surrounding Arab countries to feed, clothe, and house them. People my age have lived their entire lives in squalid refugee camps, harboring a hatred of Jews and the nation of Israel for forcing them into their miserable existence. They taught their children and grandchildren, who also lived their entire lives in refugee camps, to hate Jews everywhere. Since 1948, that simmering hatred boiled over multiple times into terrorist violence against neighboring Israelis. On December 9th, 1987, the first intifada or uprising took place, an acceleration of the violence within and surrounding Gaza. The world took notice, and in 1993, the Oslo Accords resulted in a measure of self-governance for the Palestinians living in Gaza and the West Bank, with the creation of the Palestinian Authority, which was a limited internal government, which included a Palestinian Legislative Council, sort of like our House of Representatives in Congress. In 1996, the first elections for the PLC were held, and the majority were members of a political party called Fatah, a reverse acronym of its full name in Arabic, which means the Palestinian National Liberation Movement. And it is a successor to the Palestinian Liberation Organization, founded by Yasser Arafat. Fatah, a pragmatic political party led by Mahmoud Abbas, renounced terrorism and violence in pursuit of its goals. But some Palestinians regarded Fatah as being too submissive to the Israeli oppressors and occupiers, and a second intifada or uprising occurred from 2000 to 2005, resulting in the deaths of over 3,000 Palestinians and 1,000 Israelis. In response, Israel built a continuous wall around three sides of the entire 25-mile-long by average 5-mile-wide Gaza Strip in 2005 to 2007 to contain the violence and halt the importation of weapons. Gazans today derisively claim that they are living in an open-air prison surrounded by these walls. And the living conditions in Gaza continued to be wretched, now not just in the refugee camps, but increasingly in the densely populated and impoverished Gaza Strip as a whole, a fertile breeding ground for angry terrorists and suicide bombers. The Palestinians who favored a more violent response to the Israeli occupiers broke away from Fatah in 2007 and formed a rival political party called Hamas, which is an acronym for its official name in Arabic, the Islamic Resistance Movement. That same year, an election was held, and the more strident and belligerent Hamas party gained majority control of the Gaza legislature. Hamas's anti-Israel ideology embraces violence, refuses to acknowledge the legitimacy of the State of Israel, and pursues a policy of jihad, armed war with Israel. Hamas has formed an armed militia, highly trained, funded, equipped, and controlled by one of Israel's greatest enemies in the region, Iran, to carry out rocket launches, suicide bombings, shootings, and stabbings of Israelis, including the barbaric atrocity of October 7th and the terrorist attack. And now, Brother John, we'll discuss Israel today.
Thank you, Brother Joe, for the history and background of the war, of the events, of the territory, and everything that happened. So let's bring this a little bit to our today's events. So having a war in Israel, it's probably not news for the world or for other people, but I think for us is of special interest because we know that these events, they do lead to greater events, to the events in Ezekiel 38, and ultimately will lead to the full establishment of the kingdom. So I think that's why it's of special interest for all of us. And Brother Joe went through this, but I'll go very, very quick to summarize that since 1848, Israel really suffered a lot of wars, conflicts, and it was just not a peaceful time. So we can see the on the right, we can see how many people of Israel died in the first war, and then there was the second Sinai War, then it was the sixth day, and then they continued the Yom Kippur War, which is a major one. So what I was impressed looking at the a second column from the last, from the right, how few soldiers of Israel army died. And that just shows how much they value the lives and how careful they are compared probably to other wars. And then if we move forward, Brother Joe covered this very well. But as we get closer to our day, we see that all the conflicts, they are between Israel and Hamas. Now the other Arab countries, some of them adhere more to the Oslo Accords or to the Abraham Accords, and they respect a little bit more. As far as Hamas, I don't think they just pay too much attention to that. So this on the bottom is the last one. So as far as recently, Israel probably lost around 400 soldiers, but their number is probably not as accurate. because it's an ongoing event. Now, if we look at the internal strife prior to October 7th, we know that Israel is divided religiously, and here I have a map of different religions that are in Israel. You have the ultra-Orthodox that are very conservative, the 8%, and they are the religious ones, the Masorti, and then the secular ones, and 14% of Muslims, and a few Christians. So you can see how there are a large division compared to other countries where the country is more Catholic or is more Orthodox, like Moldova or others. And definitely these religions, they do lead to a more division amongst them as a country. Now, as far as politically, here are the groups. There are that form their parliament, and then now it's the Netanyahu, the one that are in power, and then the other ones, you have the opposition, and then a few more. But it's interesting to see how, like any other Democrat country, they have the conservatives and they have the liberals, or the right and left wing as well. Now, speaking about the two groups, because in the political party you see two main groups here as well. And speaking about two groups, what I found interesting is when we look in Zechariah 14:2, this is an event that we believe it's still in the future, and we read, and I'm sure brethren will mention about this. It says, I will gather all nations to Jerusalem to fight against it. The city will be captured, the house ransacked, and the woman raped. Half of the city will go in exile, but the rest of the people will not be taken from the city. So what we see here is, again, two main groups. Now, most of the brethren believe that we think that half of the city that will go in exile or half of the city that will be taken could represent the not necessarily a physical half, but a half or a group of people that believe and that trust in their military powers, they trust in their alliances. And this is the group that will be taken or won't succeed. But the rest of the people are the people that I think we see them developing to a certain degree, are the religious ones, those that realize that the only way that they will get their hope, their final peace, it will be raising their heads and looking up to God and asking for salvation from God. And this group is called the remnant in Jeremiah and Isaiah and other prophecies as well. So I think it's good to notice how these two groups start developing to a certain degree. Now, if we look at the current unanimity, we know that before, as we mentioned, before October 7th, Israel was going through an internal strife, but when the attack happened, they realized, all parties and groups, they realized that at this point, they have a common goal. It doesn't matter what you believe, it doesn't matter what where you stand, their goal is one. And it was to release the hostages, to protect their land, and to try to do something that to prevent that from happening, especially so many conflicts with Hamas. So they formed the war cabinet, and they put their differences aside and started to work together toward that common goal. And I think that is a beautiful lesson for us as well, to realize that we as Christian, we as brethren, we do have a common goal as well. So I found that very interesting. Now, Israel's response to Hamas and Iran's allies in Gaza, the West Bank, Syria, and Lebanon, Brother Joe showed this map, but we see here on the left bottom corner is the Gaza Strip, and then on the top is Lebanon, they have the West Bank. So, I think Israel's response was one to be expected, that they are tired of ongoing conflicts with Hamas, and but as we know, this is more than just Hamas, because they got attacked or they have conflicts in the north where they have daily rockets going back and forth. So as long as they have the walls of support from U.S. and other allies, this will normally be their normal response. And as we know, behind Hamas and Lebanon and all the parties that are involved, I think it, it there is a greater influence that comes from Iran, probably. And as we know, as we look in Ezekiel 38, we see Iran there as well. Now, it is not necessarily mentioned directly, but it is the same country. And I think it's beautiful to see how we start seeing these groups getting together. And in the same time, of course, Iran is an ally with Russia as well in their conflict. And that's Ezekiel 38 coming at them as a group. So it is encouraging to see. So I think our normal response should be to watch and look, and as Psalm 132 says, pray for the peace of Jerusalem.
Okay. Brethren, I want to thank you for that wonderful introduction, and we will talk about the development of anti-Semitism. That'll be Brother Chris and Brother Dodick. And Chris, I didn't give you a warning on this, but you attended Yad Vashem. Would you just, I don't think most of the brethren know about that whole incident or that whole experience. Can you just open by talking about that before you get in?
Yes, thank you very much, Brother Richard. So back in 2012, by a recommendation of our dear brother Paul, I applied to attend a Christian leadership conference or workshop at the Yad Vashem Institute, which is the institute in Jerusalem that is commemorating all of the people who died and who perished in the Holocaust, and how they each represented a life that was lost. And all the efforts in that institute are to educate and enlighten the world about the atrocities, the spirit, the mind behind what's called and what's known as anti-Semitism. And so this was a very much of a life-changing experience. Also to know that this was my first time and so far the only time in Israel, but it was definitely very enlightening. And as far as the connection with the people who were teaching this class, these classes, and their camaraderie and appreciation for the Christians that can share this same heritage and understand the sufferings that the Jewish people have gone through, that was just a wonderfully enabled experience for me, Brother Richard. Okay, for me to share, I'm going to do just that. I have a couple of slides that do talk about anti-Semitism and how it's now coming back almost to a realization that when the nations, I apologize, I do need to start it again here, when the nations said never again at the end of World War II and favored the establishment of the nation of Israel, and through the United Nations it was recognized and approved, we yet see that the emotions, the antagonisms, and the feelings did not die that day, but rather they somehow were persisted and continued. There are many materials which you will find if you really look for them, that kind of continue to perpetuate the idea that there is a conspiracy, that the Jews are there to rule the world and to achieve their objectives. And those who have the prejudice and who are ignorant are definitely oftentimes prey to these thoughts and many different ideas. But I would say that just like we sang today in our hymn this morning about ignorance and prejudice that still rule the world, that this is the case too with the spirit of not knowing exactly what Israel is about and what the Jewish people have in their heart, and prejudice fueled by those who for ages have been vilifying the Jewish people. But as far as the ignorance, it's kind of come to the forefront with what we have seen on the news, that the moment that the atrocities of October 7th began and 1,400 plus people lost their life in the most vicious and cruel way, which was celebrated through the media by those who perpetrated this, yet the world spent just a little time recognizing this atrocity. And by the world, I say some portions of the population. And immediately the mainstream media turned attention to the injustices and justification for such behavior because of the conditions that the Palestinian people live in. But it really illustrates the ignorance and lack of understanding of what's really going on behind the scenes. Little do they perhaps know, or many people don't realize, that in 2005, Gaza was given over to the Palestinians with an amazing amount of preparation and infrastructure and funding because it was previously in Israel's hands. Israel exited Gaza then, and it was since that time an opportunity for the Jewish, the Palestinian people to make it like they would like to both be governed and prepared. And yet it seems that that's not the case, and that they have chosen and wanted to continue and perpetuate this hatred and ignorance of the people of Israel. But the voices at large don't understand this, and they demonstrate, whether it's in academic settings or other places in the streets of cities, they want to free Palestine. And the line that you hear is from the river to the sea, which really is the expression of wanting to eradicate Israel from those territories. So there is definitely a lot of ignorance and the prejudice that runs in the hearts of many. It permeates not only individuals, but also organizations that seem to condone and not squash these expressions, such as have been the initial, especially response of the governing bodies of many Ivy League schools. And we remember that when those words were said, never again, it is so reminiscent of the events from World War II, when 6 million of Jewish people perished. Here was just the beginning of those activities in 1938, 85 years ago, Kristallnacht, that was just commemorated recently. But as we look at this anti-Semitism that is happening today, we reflect on this somewhat of a parody from the channel that some time ago called Latma TV has been published on the media to really show the mindset of the nations, perhaps those who in majority always condemn Israel in the United Nations, and those that almost have returned to the old configuration of the Cossacks, that is the Russian pogroms, of the Nazis, that is those who simply in a racial way just totally bring down the validity of anything that Israel does. And those who were in Persia, like in the days of Haman and Queen Esther, when the whole nation of Israel, all the Jews there were to be destroyed. Those sentiments seem to be there, but now they are not, oh, this is just because you're a Jew, but no, this is because you're not applying these policies. This is because Israel has a greater responsibility than any other nations, and this is just because those settlements are there. Those are the new new words and new language of anti-Semitism. So what we do see, and this is my last slide before I give this over to Brother Derek, is that there is a lot of efforts, and when there are efforts, you know that there is money and there is funding. There is a country that's associated with Hamas and, in fact, participates in the negotiation, Qatar, that has funded billions of dollars to Ivy League American colleges, and it seems that there is that connection between the funding and the voices and ideologies. If you want to know more about it, there is a website called isgap.org and an interview that was recently played on Jewish Broadcasting Service television with the representation from that organization, as well as Nathan Sharansky, who is a Russian refusnik who has been fundamental and foundational in highlighting the dynamics both before and now during this whole situation. So as we continue to look at this, we certainly don't want to come across as being anti-Palestinian. We just see that the people of Palestine are under both pressure from their violent rulers, as well as a conviction that the griefs and the grievances have to be avenged and paid for. And this cycle of violence somehow does not seem to want to stop. We reflect on how human hearts have to be somehow given a motivation, and at the individual level, that turning point has to be achieved. How this will be and when this will be, we only long for those times. But in the meantime, the reality is the one of defense, of separating the wickedness. And just like in any situation where they are entrenched, just like in those tunnels, it's such a challenge to separate that. We pray that these things come to an end quickly, and we watch and we pray.
I don't know exactly where to start, so let me just quickly paint the big picture and try to explain my views a little later. So if we look at anti-Semitism right now, we see facts on the ground. We can think about roots of this anti-Semitism, but I think it's interesting what next? Are we against that? And what will this anti-Semitism bring forth in the future? And this also is related to prophecy that Brother John already mentioned. Prophecies about some kind of attack on Israel, and question is why. And that's kind of is also related to the position of the Israel on the chart of the ages. As you look at the chart of the ages, you see that Israel is pictured as a nation. It's pictured in the figure E above line P. This line P ends with the cross mark on the chart. Now, this line doesn't appear on the chart anymore. Any other figure that would represent Israel is not shown on the chart. We see figure W, which represents whole mankind and Israel in it on line N in the future. But we probably wouldn't say that Israel is in this stage yet. So where is Israel now? What is the relationship of God and Israel right now? We would tend to think that because the time of the punishment passed, is finished, Israel returned to some kind of favor. But what kind of favor? Is it line P again? Or is it still line R? And if this is line R, what is God's favor to Israel at this moment? They return to land, And question is, does it mean that we can treat Israel as a kingdom material after just slight modification and they are ready? Or is it mean that, well, they are gathered together, but they're not accepted really in this form and shape like they are right now? And there is a view that I'm thinking about, that basically gathering of Israel is for judgment, not as a expression of favor and blessing for the future, but certain judgment of Israel couldn't be performed until they are gathered together and form the nation, form the state. When they are together, certain things are developed and shown how they treat others, how they treat each other in their own state. Are they able to live according to kingdom ideas in their own state? And if we see those prophecies like Zechariah 12 and 14, and then Malachi 3rd chapter, which we tend to apply to fiery trial of the church, but they are sons of Levi mentioned by name, so I think it could also be applied to Israel. I think that we could think about certain period of time that will be judgment of Israel, of their current position, current organization on what they do, how they do things in this world. So how is anti-Semitism related to that? Well, if we think about nations gathering against Israel, I think that probably what will happen that this anti-Semitism will be growing. And now we have the case of polarization. So let's say that I would like to critique some policies of Israel. Can I do that? Well, the world is so polarized that I will be right away either labeled as a friend of Israel and enemy of other side, or I will be placed as an member of the anti-Semitism group, friend of Palestinian and enemy of Israel. I think there is no place for constructive, objective criticism of Israel today. And this probably will follow. Right now we see events around the Europe, and Brother Richard mentioned China. That's also an interesting case. And I think this is a new kind of anti-Semitism related to recent events, because maybe we should go to roots just for a moment. I think there are two roots of anti-Semitism that are merging together and creating explosive thing. So the first root is the Christianity. Well, Christianity started anti-Semitism. And when Christianity came to power, it was kind of idea that maybe Jews could be wiped out at that moment. But there was something like idea of witnesses that Christian church developed, idea of that Jews are witnesses of that what happened at time of when Jesus was on the earth. So they should be preserved as a witnesses. And that kind of preserve those relationship between Christianity and Jewish nation. It was also picked up by the Muslim regime later when Palestine was under the government of Muslims. So this is the very old source of anti-Semitism. Main issue is that they killed Jesus Christ or caused the Romans to kill him. And they are working together with Satan to take control over the world. Well, there was those accusation of causing the Black Death in Europe, or that they kill children for blood. All false accusations, but they were created because of this feeling that, you know, they are not us, they are others, so we can blame them for many things. And it grew up, and you can say that Catholic countries develop much more anti-Semitism than other countries. I know that some Catholic priests in Poland are quite anti-Semitic. Interesting fact that the most anti-Semitic country in Europe right now is Ireland, where there is no Jews, because of Christian influence and because they are kind of relation with military units, groups in Palestine. Okay, so how to end this this thing? Well, one question for us: where are we in all this thing? Can we be on both sides at the same time? Because that's the difficult thing. It's very difficult to see both sides and be on both sides. You have to choose one or the other, and it's easier. Now, we see the events of October 7th, then 1,400 Jews were killed. Now, look at what happens now. What is the response of Israel? 14,000 or more than 10,000. First thing that dies during the war is truth. So we don't know what numbers are really. But if somebody says that it's more than 10,000 and 70% is women and children, what do we do with this number? Do we justify it, seeing that Israel is again chosen nation and God deals with them, and we should support no matter what? Or should we see things that are not good and criticize them? And will we be pushing the anti-Semitic camp at that moment? So that's question for us, how we deal with this, those problems that are developing in Israel. Thank you.
Thank you. And you brought up the subject of strategic alliances, which we're going to ask Brother Brett and Jack to go through, and keep in mind the time, because I know you have a lot of slides. Okay.
Thank you, Brother Richard. Well, our section of the panel study is involved with the strategic military alignments and preparation for what happens in Ezekiel 38 and 39. And you'll recall in Ezekiel 38, we're told of a confederation of countries that go against Israel to take a spoil. We call these the outer ring countries. These countries are identified by the names of Japheth's sons and Ham's sons, found in Genesis, the 10th chapter, and the areas they populated. But prior to this final battle, we looked at Psalm 83, verses 4 and 5, which identifies a coalition of immediately surrounding Arab countries, that is, an inner ring of countries, that unite to make war with Israel, to, as the scripture states, let us cut them off from being a nation, that the name of Israel may be no more in remembrance. We believe the conflicts with Hamas currently is identifiable as a part of the attempt to fulfill that scripture. But we also learned that in Ezekiel 38, 11, and 12, speaking of the outer ring Confederate countries, and thou shalt say, I will go up to the land of unwalled villages. I will go to them that are at rest, that dwell safely, all of them dwelling without walls, and having neither bars nor gates, to take a spoil and to take a prey, to turn thine hand upon the desolate places that are now inhabited, and upon the people that are gathered out of the nations, which have gotten cattle and goods, that dwell in the midst of the land. Certainly, Israel is not at peace currently. So we considered what is happening now that indicates where things are headed to fulfill God's prophecies. There has been a recent increase in heavy barrages coming into Israel from Hezbollah in Lebanon. We're seeing a major escalation between Hezbollah and Israel, both in the terrorist group's attacks, aggression, and rhetoric. Will Hezbollah open a second front? It is believed they will, since Israel is currently concentrating on Hamas. Yeah, Brother Brett is going to talk about the nations we're talking about and when they will unite.
Well, thank you, Brother Jack, for that overview and that nice correlation between Psalm 83 and Ezekiel 38. And I think you'll see in the two various passages, Brother Jack's right, there's an inner ring and an outer ring. I'll try to show you what those things look like. So first and foremost, who are the nations that are in Psalm 83? They are the tents of Edom, Ishmaelites, the Moab and the Hagrites, Gebal and Ammon and Amalek, Philistia, as Brother Joe mentioned earlier, with the inhabitants of Tyre, and Assyria. Now, Binion is also mentioned, but they are not involved in this case. They're mentioned in a historical reference to what had happened to them before. So what's our correlation with this? Well, we can actually take a look at where these tribes were located and put them in the land in various places. And you'll see that Esau, for example, who was represented by Edom, settled southeast of the Dead Sea. And in maybe one thing of note, every one of these particular tribal identifications is identified with a specific area, except for one, and that's the Ishmaelites. There is no specific area for Ishmaelites because of something that we'll get to in a little bit. And one other note is when you look at the geography currently today, most of these settlements are in the area of Israel or Jordan. Of course, Philistia, as Brother Joe mentioned, is partly related to Palestine in terms of the root word and is very much aligned on the coast, really all the way up to Ashkelon, which is further into Israel now. And then, of course, Lebanon and all the way with Assyria over to Iraq. And then if you look at the descendancies of each one of these individuals or the tribes that are mentioned in nations as nations in Psalm 83, most of the descendancies go to Shem. Some go to Ham as well. And there's something I'll make a point of as we get to that. And, of course, most of the land in Israel and Palestine was first settled by Canaan. As we know from scripture in Genesis. So let's take a look at where this shows up on the map. And apologize, this may not be terribly easy to see, but I think the principle of what you see is that if you look at the compass, the little wheel in the middle where Israel would be, it's surrounded by these nations. So this is the inner ring that Brother Jack was talking about. And I think the obvious question, given the Israel-Hamas war, is, are the Palestinians included in this? And I think the answer is yes. The Palestinians are included in this. As Brother Joe mentioned, the Palestinian Liberation Group, the PLO, which was the initial instantiation of the Palestinian ability to manage themselves under Arafat. Well, those were Arab nationals who in 1947, up until that point of the war, normally resided in the Palestine area. And that was regardless of whether they were evicted there or stayed there. So if you ask somebody what's a Palestinian today, the technical definition is somebody who just lived there in that particular region where Israel and Palestine are now. In addition, there's another saying to describe this particular area as a whole. And if you look up and do research on any one of the nations that's here and or the tribes, you'll find that they're associated with something called the Levant. And the Levant is generally that strip which became Palestine and includes some of the broader area as well. So let's move on to some of the fulfillments of Psalm 83 in terms of these strategic alliances. And we've got the nations listed, as we mentioned before, on the left. Now, maybe we should talk first about what an Arab is, because that is not necessarily something that is easily defined. I think you will find a common definition of an Arab. It's thought to be a descendant of the tribe of Ishmael or of Ishmael. That's in general. But as you noted, when we looked at the alignments before, and you, as you'll see, Arabs is a much broader group and actually includes descendants of Ham through Canaan and others. And so it's really all of those various peoples that settled in the North Africa, Middle East region in general sense. And they've done studies in particular in the Levant area and determined that there is no distinct genetic difference between the various peoples that settled there. So if you were to say, is somebody Jordanian, is somebody Lebanese, is somebody, Palestinian, technically speaking, as a group, as a whole, there's not a significant genetic delineation there. It doesn't mean that there aren't specific individuals that would obviously have DNA or genetics from other regions, from their ancestry specifically. But as a whole, this particular genetic is really one genetic ethnicity as a whole. And that's why they associate themselves with being called Arabs, and there's not an issue with that. So let's take a look at the nations in this context. So in 1945, prior to the events of 1947 and 1948 that Brother Joe shared with us, the Arab League was formed. And the Arab League currently has 22 member nations. They were 21. They added a 22nd member. The five that are listed at the top here, Jordan, Kuwait, Iraq, Lebanon, and Syria, are generally the ones that would be associated with the tribes on the left. But you see that there's a whole bunch more that are in that Arab League that may come from different genetic descendancies, from other peoples. Saudi Arabia, as an example, is a very mixed country. If you look at the whole country, there is some debate as to whether or not they were descendants of Canaan or descendants of Shem. And it probably depends on the individual and the area of Saudi Arabia we're talking about. Also, the same goes for Yemen, which is down on the south coast of Saudi Arabia. In any event, a lot of North African countries as well are part of the Arab League. Now, in 1945, their slogan was extermination. In 1967, it was obliteration, and this was in regards to Israel. As I mentioned, the PLO became a full member of the Arab League. That was in 1976. And then because Egypt, as also Brother Joe showed, signed a peace treaty with Israel, Egypt was suspended from the Arab League for 10 years, from 1979 to 1989. And of course, boycotts of Israel have been going on the entire time since the Arab League was founded, and they've only grown more significant of late as well amongst Arab League nations. Now, as of today, 16 of 22 Arab League members do not recognize Israel, and that includes some of the big players, even in the Israel-Hamas war, including Qatar or Qatar. We know that Iran has been mentioned as behind the extremist Islamic Palestinians. They are calling for annihilation of Israel, and there's a number of other things that are going on. But two things of note related to these alliances. One is that, as Brother Chris mentioned, there are global community calls to condemn Israel and to really put pressure on Israel for what's going on. And many countries, including some of those that have established and recognized Israel in the Arab League, have withdrawn their diplomats. So there's a lot going on, a lot of things moving around. Yeah, there. So a couple of other notes very quickly. I won't get into the depth of the Muslim Brotherhood and Islamist extremist legitimacy of jihad, but that is a real thing. They of course, believe that it's important and justified. Some of the Psalm 83 nations still want to destroy Israel, but many have recently, prior to this particular thing on October 7th and the resulting war, they actually recognize the value of peace with Israel and have opened up trade with Israel. I mean, if you talk to any of the Arab League partners, even some of the ones that don't recognize Israel formally, they trade with Israel. It's very important economically in the region to cooperate, and they do it. And then one thing to maybe watch is that Egypt and Iran are not mentioned in Psalm 83. Neither one of them is. But Iran is obvious, as was mentioned in Ezekiel 38. And, of course, the peoples that are in Egypt, it's a whole nother study, but it's very interesting to what's going on. We'll talk about polarization in a minute, but the Arab consensus has now transitioned, we think. And, of course, peace and trade has now become, you know, jihad. And so this is what I would just suggest that we look for. Is the Arabian Peninsula, I think, will be a big factor. We've already seen missiles sent from Yemen into the area that have been taken out by the U.S., and it's possible that they will be a factor in both prophecies. There's also something that's very substantial going on with the Islam portion of this, and that is the Sunni-Shia divide. That has traditionally been, since Islam was founded, a very big divide, right? Big wars, Iraq hates Iran, Iran hates Iraq, you know, lots of things going back and forth because of the difference between the two factions of Islam. Well, just recently, Iran, as a result of some of the things that are going on in Yemen, made a small peace brokering with Saudi Arabia, which is different because Saudi Arabia and Iran are on two opposite sides of this Sunni-Shia debate. And so there may be some more alliances coming. It's something to look out for. And of course, as we see what happens in Psalm 83, there is destruction of these enemies. So we're looking to see if that's going to be a literal destruction or a symbolic one and result in peace in the Middle East. And as we know, we know this will lead into Ezekiel 38. So here's a map with Ezekiel 38 and Psalm 83 overlaid on top of each other. This is my alignment, so don't take it, you know, some quoted source and being accurate. But I will tell you, I think it represents the consensus of thinking about migration of peoples and tribes initially. If you look at Magog, Meshach, and Tubal, those all settled in Turkey. Those nations identified in Ezekiel 38 settled in Turkey. But there's no doubt that there was migratory action northward and eastward. And as Brother Richard has pointed out previously, there's a very strong likelihood and correlation that Beth Togarmah actually represents China, because there's been a number of things. I'll let him explain in more detail. If you don't remember, he went through some evidences, including some genetic testing that were very interesting in that. So if we look at how this battle in Ezekiel 38 plays out, all of these nations are this outer circle that Brother Jack talked about, and they're going to center around the inner circle that we showed before, which includes the nations of Psalm 83.
Minute more.
Yes. And I'll turn it back to Brother Jack right now. Just one point on Ezekiel 38 and Psalm 83 is that we often think of a different outcome when we think of both of those chapters. But one of the end consequences of Psalm 83 very much parallels Ezekiel 38, and that is that the nations there will know that you alone, whose name is the Lord of Jehovah, is the Most High over all the earth. And I think Brother Jack has a couple more things to share on the alliance.
I ask you to just spend a minute, because we're really running out of going over time here. Okay. Thank you.
All right, a little tough here to do that, but there's a couple slides we wanted to show. There's an article that appeared in November 21st, 2023, and it had to do with Russia's Wagner Group. They're preparing to provide air defenses to Lebanon's Hezbollah terror group. And you recall that the Wagner Group was headed by Yevgeny Prigozhin, who led a brief group against Vladimir Putin before dying under very suspicious circumstances earlier this year. So we can see that Russia, one of the nations believed to be part of the coalition that attacks Israel, as outlined in Ezekiel 38, cooperating with and supplying weaponry to Iran, another country identified in the coalition of Ezekiel 38, and understood to be a sponsor of Hezbollah. The war continues against Israel from the immediate neighbors. So much bloodshed and death of innocent Jews and Palestinians will pave the way for peace. And then the unwalled condition of Israel will entice the countries identified in Ezekiel 38 to join and attack. So, I don't know, Brother Richard, we can go on more.
Due to the time, I think we need to press on to the next section, but I want to thank you, brethren, for this wonderful introduction and bringing us up here. We recognize it.
It's an interesting country because they're working a tightrope between the East and the West. They're a member of NATO, yet they're beholden to Russia for the many favors that Russia has done for them in the sense of economics. So, well, you can see here there's the Turkish pipeline and so forth. We were going to talk about that, but we will move on.
Brother Jack and Brother Brett, I want to thank you. And we're going to just focus on not only the alliances, but the polarization that's taking place. And so turning over to Brother Aaron and Brother Joe Megas to talk about the polarization. And then I have to apologize. We're a little bit scrunched on time here. So,
all right. Can you hear me okay? Good. So there's three basic areas, three questions I want to just really quickly address. Is how do we understand the global spread of political polarization? And the Carnegie Endowment did a study in 2019. So this is already 4 years old, but they said that many of the roots, patterns, and drivers of polarization were the same across 9 countries that they studied. The United States was one of them. So polarizing leaders often relentlessly inflame basic divisions and entrench them throughout society. 2, electoral success. 2, they aggravate tensions by demonizing opponents. 3, they curtail democratic processes. 4, they push for radical changes. All of which we've seen in the news in the recent, in Poland and some of the other countries. person that's in power is in the opposition, radicalizes and demonizes. When they get into position and power, then they do those things. They demonize their opponents, they change the democratic processes to their benefit, and they push for changes to their benefit. And opposition leaders, the ones who are opposing them, they do something very similar. They fan anti-democratic and confrontational tactics of their own. So those in power are doing certain things. Those who are trying to compete for the power are doing very similar things, all of which continually feed into this polarization. The effects of polarization affects all essential areas of democracy. So it undermines the independence of the judiciary. We see that already. So some countries, Israel tried to gut their judiciary as politicians attack the courts and pack them with loyalists. You see that with the United States. We saw our president pack the courts. In presidential systems, it leads to abuse of executive powers and promotes the toxic view that the president represents only his or his supporters' point of view and not the country as a whole. That's very specific to the United States. And then it changes the norms of tolerance and moderation, like conceding electoral defeat after an election. Okay, so those are the things that are common across these countries. But they said the U.S. polarization stands out as something above all of that, and is unusual. So they said that most polarization in these other countries is a couple generations, a couple decades long. They said the United States goes back for 50, 60 years already. And it's a struggle between competing or contending conservative and progressive visions of the country. So you have two parties, one progressive, one restrictive, conservative, and they have that conflict. So, all right, that's the first question. So the next question is how far would the U.S. go to defend Israel? So when Israel first started, our president came out and says, we have unequivocal support for the nation of Israel. And the Republicans are backing them. And what's happening over time is, since October, is that with the polls, the support of Republicans is going up, the support of Democrats are going down. Biden's a Democratic president. So what that means is that as this Hamas in Israel war continues, the nations are going to look at the damage that's being done by the war, and most people tend to side on the part of the loser. They take the side of the weaker person. That's just a natural thing. So the global opinion is shifting away from Israel and shifting towards supportive Palestinian efforts and Hamas. So what does that mean for the United States? Well, it's the same thing as happening in the United States. So we are going to have less stomach for funding Israel because we are comprised of a nation that is also Palestinians, and you're hearing their voices in the news. And they've already come out and said that as a bloc, they are going to not vote for Biden already. And the war is still in progression. So for the Democratic president to maintain his position, he needs a large bloc of voters across all of the United States. So how far will Israel go? How far will U.S. go to defend Israel? That depends upon who's elected. And that also depends upon what happens with Israel and Hamas right now. Because the longer it goes, the less the world is going to support Israel, and the more they're going to favor Hamas. All right, so that's the United States. So what happens to Europe? Does the Hamas-Israel war make Europe vulnerable? Now, Derek mentioned that a lot of refugees have come into Europe. And 5 years ago already, Europe was really concerned that there are so many immigrants coming in that do not share the European viewpoint, that third generation, in one generation, they will become a voting bloc that will outnumber the native Europeans and change the whole political drama and scope in that country and in the country. So in one generation, that was 5 years ago. So Israel's military campaign against Hamas is an opportunity to destabilize Western societies an attack they're most hated for Israel. And the immigrants who arrived in recent years in Europe's shores shouldn't be too difficult to include into this group, to make them members. So they will use dedicated social media campaigns to spread their anti-Israel and anti-Western propaganda as widely as possible. Now, they will further fuel anti-Semitic sentiments, and Israel's war against Hamas is destined to deepen societal, religious, and political polarizations in many European countries for some time to come. So we are just seeing the tip of the iceberg. Now, the United States is currently backing, the biggest backer for Israel. We have Iran that doesn't want to touch Israel because the United States holds a club over Iran. They won't get involved because the United States has too much authority and power. What happens when the United States loses political opinion or the international opinion? Or the United States says, as a government, we are not going to support Israel anymore. Now there's a red light is removed. It goes to a green light for all the surrounding countries that Brett and Brother Jack talked about. Iran has no mechanism to prevent them from moving in. Yemen, Qatar, all these other countries now have a green light to go in against Israel. And the United States will sit back because we have decided that we are not going to support them because it's not to our political advantage to do so. Who knows when that's going to happen? It could be within this next election cycle. We don't know. So, yes, my last comment is, our main text today, Revelation 3:10, says, because you have kept the word of my perseverance, I also will keep you from the hour of testing, that which is about to come upon the whole world, to test those who dwell on the earth. You and I are living in this time frame. You and I will probably see some of these events transpire. And Jesus said in John 14, peace I leave with you. My peace I give to you. Not as the world gives, do I give to you. Do not let your heart be troubled, nor let it be fearful. Because we are in the care and keeping of the creator of the universe, who has personally promised his protection in our lives.
And Brother Joe, is there anything you wanted to... Okay, thank you. Thank you, brethren. Last, we want to ask Brett and Chris and then the other members of the panel to join in. What can we do? What can we do to be a comfort to Israel?
It's definitely a challenging question for each of us because we have respectively different circumstances and different situations in our lives as we look at the situation transpiring in the world and in Israel. We may not have a way to personally touch those who are going through these different difficulties and experiences. So there is definitely the more action oriented or assistance oriented setting that we can take, and there is definitely many ways in through which you can we can reach out and in some way help those who are going through these difficulties. On the other hand, through a more of an intellectual and emotional support, we definitely know that we have a lot of strength, and we are standing on some grounds that really have been set in the Bible students' expectations of blessings eventually to be coming to the nation of Israel. And I just wanted to show a number of books that we are definitely privileged to both have familiarized and have available for our own education, as well as to share with anyone who wants to know about the expectations and hopes for the Jewish people. So here is even all the way back from Pastor Russell's days, and we do remember that he was the early American Christian Zionist who, before many others have seen it, saw in the prophecies that the hope for Israel's regathering was real and it will be there. And even when the JW organization lost that hope in 1930s. The hope of this original message came true, as we know, in 1948. An assembly of booklets that brethren have written over the years. Brother Ken Rawson, known as Pastor Kenneth Rawson to many of those who heard his presentation, Israel Appointment with Destiny, will definitely relate to that. Those materials are available both on the Chicago website as well as on Israel Appointment with Destiny website. Here are some booklets that really can be used for us to enter the emotion of those who are considering, from the Jewish people, who are considering what this is, where is God's word pointing to, and especially this one, Israel's Land Rights, is an interesting and detailed booklet going through the details similar to what Brother Joe had covered, and with some documents and some citations, as well as this one, Embrace Your Jewish Heritage, written by Brother Ken, that I think was one of his last publications, encouragement for the Jewish people to look at the promises that God has for them, encourage them to maintain faith, to stay true to the word of God, and be encouraged, perhaps even consider whether it is their time, if they live somewhere away from Israel, to immigrate. So I think we have both a wonderful tradition and different ways in which we can help. Staying tuned to the latest information is helpful. Listening to channels such as Jewish Broadcasting Station, which has, I think, a good balance of a lot of valid information, and many others, Brother Richard.
Brett, you're
take a quick minute. Just to add to that, I think I really appreciate, you know, the work of the brethren that have gone before that have spent time in Israel. I am by no means an expert, and I walk in everybody else's footsteps somewhat far behind. But I would just say that, you know, in terms of how we can be a comfort to Israel, I think it's very clear what the church should be doing, and these activities definitely align with that and support that. And I think the empowerment we get for that is Isaiah 52, the entire chapter. But in particular, verses 6 and 7, I'll read them. This is God speaking. Therefore, my people shall know my name. Therefore, in that day, I am the one who is speaking. Here I am. This is what we want to point them to, that they recognize God through the scriptures. And then what's for us is verse 7. How lovely on the mountains are the feet of him who brings good news. The feet of him, that's us. We bring good news. We announce peace. We bring good news of happiness. We announce salvation and say to Zion, your God reigns. And the key takeaway of this is that our message is the gospel of peace. It's not about support of the secular aspects of the world that's going on right now. We know the Lord's great army is at work. We don't want to get in the way of that, but we want to provide the comfort. And the scriptures are clear about comfort and hope. And we hope that the efforts of the brethren will continue to bear results in turning the Jews that are looking for Jehovah to find him. And we're very thankful for so many that have gone before.
Oh, P.S. from me, if I may. Website Be Safe, BSAIF, Bible Students Alliance for Israel's Future, is a wonderful resource. And I just want to say we appreciate the efforts of the brethren who have organized the tours, who have established a presentation of the Lindquist Tabernacle in the Biblical Tamar Park, and all of those of the Bible students who have gone there to both support it, appreciate it, and maintain the connection with the Jewish people.
Brethren, I want to thank you. Are there any final comments from the panel? I want to say I really think you did you all did an excellent job on preparing and bringing this forth to the brethren at this time, and we're watching. We have to keep watching. There's a lot ongoing, and there's certainly going to be more challenges for us as supporters of Israel as time goes on, because as Brother Aaron pointed out, everything says it's going to be turning, the sentiment at some point is going to be turning away from support for Israel, even though it's strong right now.